Hello, ESBK Studio listeners. Again, there's no intro in this one. This is your host, Richard Dort, and it is episode 26. And in this episode, I do an interview with Kyle Ginnivan of the Buckeye Current. We had done this interview once before, and right a few days after, I think, after the Isle of Man, or the podium at the Isle of Man, and it did not record. So it took a couple more weeks to schedule a new interview. We finally got together, and I think it's kind of interesting because it's at a point where he's had a couple of weeks to digest everything and go through all the hoopla and recognition and things like that. There's been some things that now Kyle's moved on. He's graduated. There have been some things. We have not seen Virginia Tech this year. They're building a bike specifically for this series. I believe the team lead there as well graduated and moved on. But I can't remember for certain. Probably some of you know. And I have not gotten a hold of them to see what's going on down there. We also thought we'd see the Buckeye Current here at Indy, and that did not happen. So it's kind of a bit of a disappointment of what actually came of it. But Kyle and I talk for an hour and 17 minutes, and it's just it's always good talking to Kyle and being able to geek out a little bit. I enjoy him. He's a cool guy. So anyway, without further ado, here's Kyle. Hello, ESBK Studio listeners. This is your host, Richard Dort. It is the 22nd of June, and I have Kyle Ginnivan on the phone to talk about his experience at the Isle of Man. How you doing today, Kyle?
I'm doing wonderful today.
Sweet. It's going good. I'm a little distracted by the bicycles right at the moment. Lots of exciting stuff happening at the shop. But this isn't about bicycles. This isn't about bicycles. This is about electric motorcycles. You just got back, like, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I think 2 weeks ago on a Sunday. Yeah, so a little...
Little less than 2 weeks ago. We did do this conversation once before.
Indeed.
And it didn't record. So how's your time off been?
Pretty good. Good. We spent, we've been meeting on and off with the team, nothing too hardcore, looking at data and just looking at what's next. So even since I talked to you last, we've had a couple team meetings, just going over what we're going to do in the future, but it's been pleasant to be back. We've gotten good reception from all the faculty back at school, the professors, the staff and stuff, and other student projects and stuff. So well received, and we're happy to be home and really enjoyed ourselves at the Isle.
Nice. That's really good to hear. It's almost cool that we're doing this now that you've had another week or so to kind of digest everything. When we left off, we'll go right back to where we left off. I did interview you right after Friday's practice.
Yeah.
And you guys were going to make some modifications to the cooling system. I think most of it was you're adding temperature sensors before and aft things and this and that. What did you do Friday night to prepare for Saturday's practice, and how did Saturday's practice go?
I think it was Saturday's the Monday, because Saturday was the really bad practice where we had a lot of resets. And then,
right. Oh, we did talk after Saturday, didn't we?
Yeah. So, but anyways, between then and then, you're right on the things we kind of looked at. We went in for Monday's practice. We didn't do too much, but we did a lot of dyno testing to try to isolate what the actual reason it reset well over 40 times, and it did it for multiple reasons. So it still had the original error with hardware overcurrent, which we're still kind of looking into. It's kind of a mystery. Not a mystery to us, but it's something that a couple things could solve. But other than that, we basically believe there was some loose 12-volt wiring and such that was intermittent, basically, connection. So the controller was seeing low voltages on its everything that needed power and was cutting out on us. So we just kind of went through every little connection and just tested it and redid some that we needed to button it up and then put it on the dyno, and things seemed to be working well and we're getting good performance. So that's what we did between then and that our last practice on Monday.
we had talked last time. The Dino situation turned out to be a bit fun, didn't it? How does that Dino thing work? You had said that there's a bit of a procedure.
Well, actually, on the aisle, it was actually very nice because the Dinos just set up in the pit, so we had to wait a little bit between other teams practice or between the other races and stuff. They don't want bikes shuffling in and out there. But we actually just rolled up to the Dino, and the guy, it's something like 20 pounds, so it's a lot cheaper rate than we'll get trying to set a Dino up here somewhere. But no, it wasn't really anything too special. He let us come on, do a couple pulls, change a setting, do another pull, change a setting, and took about 10 minutes or so, but we got some, it was nice because of how easy and simple it was in moving forward, because we originally did an engine dyno connecting just our motor controller up to a big dyno, and yep. You know, that was nice, but, and it helped a little bit. We didn't use that data as much as we could have. So it almost seems like we'd rather just wait till we get the whole system together, put it on that wheel dyno, and just, you know, rip the crap out of everything and just see what breaks and what's limiting us. Because it just, the data feedback and the instant, you know, it took us 10 minutes and we got so much data that we could just check all the systems and stuff on. So I highly recommend doing wheel dynos and the bigger teams already do that and know that. But especially when our biggest problem was trying to find track time where we didn't have to spend thousands of dollars or drive all over the country, so.
You're right. Exactly. You said someone pulled in right behind you? Because wasn't it like there was no one in the dyno and you weren't sure if you were going to be able to go in? And?
Well, no. I mean, one thing is it was funny, we rolled up and I think like two bikes back after we were in there, Mugen ended up coming up. And so we don't know it was kind of cool. They noticed us walking by if it was coincidence or if, you know, they saw us like, ooh, we better go dyno too or whatever. See what's going on, so.
That's cool. And did you have a bit of a crowd? Did you draw a bit of a crowd?
A little bit. It's, like I said, it's over kind of in the pits, or not necessarily the pits, but, Parc Formé, and also, like, the pre-staging, so there's not a ton of traffic through there, especially when there's practices and stuff, they limit who can get in there. But, I mean, there were quite a few bikes, and we always got a scene, not necessarily scene, but when we were either pushing our bike, A, because it weighs a million pounds, so you see three people having to push a giant bike, or when we would drive it up to the pits just because it's an eerie sound of this bike that's easily going 2 miles an hour with, you know, no noise, no effort at all. So we'd get some crowds and stuff around us, and it was nice because we had a large team, too, so, like, you know, we were already a big crowd and just kind of funneling through things, so.
Drew some attention. Very cool, very cool. Yeah, Saturday's practice didn't go so hot. We did talk about that, and I completely forgot. So much for my preparation and notes. how did Monday's practice go?
So Monday's went well. It was the best time. I think we did a 91.77 or something. You know, we didn't lose the whole pack completely, but we were getting pretty low on a battery that – later on race day when we had a better balance wasn't an issue. We did hit a bunch of, we still had, I think, one reset at the beginning of the race, but Rob was starting to get a feel for when it would sort of kick in so he could kind of modulate himself with the throttle to avoid it. But he had one reset, so that was all. And ran, you know, pretty much from a, you know, air standpoint, nothing necessarily else went wrong, but we did have a thermal limit for most of the point, and we were racing it. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so it was the hottest time. But the motor temperature limit was our next limiting factor, so we learned that, and that sort of led into what we kind of wanted to do and decided to do for race day.
All right, and well, that rolls right into that. You ran fastest time, your fastest time, which was still 2 miles an hour faster than Kingston at that point, right?
Yeah, well, I think. Fastest I remember Kingston running was an 88, and I think they ran that. I think they ran it on that Monday and in the race.
Oh, okay. I thought they'd run an 89 off the top of my head. Okay, sorry about that. Thank you for.
But I think a couple years ago, their collegiate record was an 89 something.
Oh, okay. So you guys broke. You had an official collegiate record then.
Yeah.
On Monday.
Yeah.
All right. So rolling into the race, what did you, or after Monday, what modifications did you guys decide to do?
So we finally got a new rear shock in, and basically what that helped was it set the race sag a lot better. So his initial ride height was a lot better, and it was I think we went from like a 120 rear, and I think that's measured in the Newton meters, to a 150 or yeah. 140 or 150 Newton meters. So a pretty good step up, and that helped him a lot with ground clearance. We were still scraping, and he was still limited, but we definitely believe that he was getting a lot higher corner speeds. And then we, let's see, what else did we do? We changed, we added some higher power fans on the rear, the motor radiator to help it. And we believe that helped because our average power increased a bit. Took a couple other things out of the cooling loop just to try to get better flow. Trying to think. I think that
things, feels, by things you mean just sensors, not actual.
Yeah, pumps. Like we took out. I'm trying to think what it was. We had a flow sensor in there that, you know, we just took the static measurement because it theoretically would just stay the same in flow. So we didn't want no real reason to necessarily measure it too much, especially because we didn't have any end goal to use the data quite yet. So we took that out to help. You know, that just can slow the flow down. So, and it was a nice 90-degree bend, so it took up some room and stuff, so we took that out. But, yeah, that didn't do too much else there. We're going to continue moving forward, making more cooling changes, because that still ended up being our limit for race day. But we actually saw more resets. We dynoed again before Wednesday as well, just to see what we could do with higher RPMs, and we ended up giving him 100 more RPMs on the motor, which was a good 3, 4, 5 miles an hour during the actual race. But we're not – that could have potentially led to some of the overcurrent errors we ended up getting, because we ended up with 5 or 6 that race, which is weird because we even lowered the current. So we think it's just something with the controllers, what we sort of come down to, and – we've got ideas, and we're talking to the manufacturer and just trying to work through that to see if there's anything we can do moving forward. But, yeah, most of the things – so, in general, the things we did to before race day made the bike – should have made the bike faster in their respects. Fortunately, with more resets, it slowed us down because there's time where he's off the throttle waiting for the whole system to kind of boot back up and then back on the throttle, and he's using more energy and more time. So it's unfortunate because we had more in the bike, but you know, he still put out a 90.4 miles an hour to put us in third place, so it's pretty stellar.
Hell yeah. He was flying the first half of that lap, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was up a couple miles an hour. It was interesting because a different, you know, from the couple of practices, with even just a reset could put him at a certain – one reset could maybe put him 3 to 5 miles an hour different paces. So it was kind of interesting to see. Even with a couple resets in the beginning of the lap there, he was basically as fast as he was, I think, in practice. And then the real point where he, I think, struggled was – as he, after Ramsey Hairpin, once he starts going up the mountain, if you get a reset on that hill, you're going to decelerate so quickly. And if you're already thermally limited on the motor, getting back up to the speed you were maintaining. So I think that's where he lost a lot of time when it was resetting there. And then we had some erroneous air, a whole new air start coming up when he was on the top, on basically the top of the mountain. So. I kind of making it sound like everything was going wrong, but that, I mean, that's just what we see with the data. But the batteries were well, the temperature of them, everything held together. We weren't loosing parts off the bike. We were scraping a couple spots, but you know, it was good feedback for us, and
yeah,
more than happy with the outcome that came about. It's funny, you know, every week further and further away, I'll kind of not forget the excitement, but I'll be more and more critical, I think, of like, oh, if we could have done this, or, you know, in anticipation of what we can do better, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you're being a little perfectionist and going, man, I, you know, yeah, absolutely. Let's see here. Speaking of which, listen, where do I want to go with this? Oh, Sulby Strait. Before I go too far deep, mm-hmm. You guys hit like 122 going down the Sulby Strait.
Yeah, we were up. I think in practice, he's like one. We were up five, almost. I think 5 miles an hour at least, and even at the grandstand too, we were up 3 miles an hour. Then that's where they take the actual speed trap. So, you know, what we did with more RPM definitely helped. And, you know, in the future, we also were thinking about re-gearing too, but we decided to just try it in software instead of the only gearing we could do was a front sprocket, and it involved quite a bit of work, and we didn't want to take off too much and you know, run into something unforeseen. So we're just kind of like, let's leave it. Yeah, we were, you know, we expected to go faster and knew there was more power to go faster, just whether the whole system would sort of hold together. And, you know, even other parts of the course, he had a higher motor RPM, so.
Sweet. So he was definitely using it.
Yeah. And could have used more, which is good. I mean, you know, not necessarily good, but it means, okay, we know where, you know, top speed is definitely an issue. And the interesting thing with that is, you know, you got to not only make your batteries better, but your motor's got to be either re-geared or stronger. So takes a not a whole revamp, but a lot of work goes into that.
Yeah. So he finishes. He has a mess of resets going up the hill. Then has a clear run home. Still runs. What was it? 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, 90.4, nice. .. I don't remember what the rest was.
Now, you got to talk to Mark Miller?
Yeah, after the race, actually, because our paddock was kind of catty corner. They were essentially, Moto2's was right across from us where Rob's paddock was, which is where we were working. And I went over and he was over there, and yeah, he was just telling me, and you can see even in the TV coverage they did of it, they showed the point where they were both went over Beloff Bridge, and at that point Mark Miller was behind John McGinnis and saw him, you know, kind of give it a bit and take off right over the bridge, and that's where the bikes get a lot of air. They're not going too fast. I mean, for the bridge itself, they're going quite a bit faster than normal people. And, you know, Mark Miller just gave it an extra bit, and he came down, and something in the gearbox just maybe a bearing, maybe gear tooth together just kind of snapped, and it didn't bind up, but, you know, maybe something just slipped out so that he could never get power anymore and just had to coast off and stop. So,
Damn, it sucks. But you guys went from a pretty solid fourth place to getting Rob Barber back on the podium for, like, his, what, fourth time?
No, that's a good question. I don't know how many times he's been up there.
Well, he won the inaugural TTX GP, which was not an official TT race. It was an exhibition race. But he won that. And then he got second the year Mark Miller won it. I'm pretty sure.
That would have been the next year, yeah.
That would have been the next year.
I think this is his third podium in the TT.
And then he got a third.
He got a third?
He got a third. No, he got a third with you guys.
Yeah, he got...
Instead of first, second, and third.
He was fourth last year.
Right, fourth last year. And then there was 1 year I don't think he finished or didn't race it. Okay, so this is his third podium. So yeah, he's been on every step of the podium so far.
Yeah. Right.
Yep, he's there. Okay, cool. Sorry. The signal just cleared up, so I was like, is he there? cool. So before we go on to talking more about Rob Barber, let's give Motosys some credit. What was it like to watch those guys? I mean, it was two experienced racers, an engineer, a crew chief, and a dad who apparently can do everything. Has no problem doing everything on the bike. What was it like to watch those guys take on the bigger organization of Mugen?
You know, when we could see them, because they're pretty secretive and kind of keep their paddock tight, buttoned up. They gave us a couple of moments to kind of come over and chat with them. when no one else was around and asked some questions. But it was cool. I really liked the guys and got to chat with them. And I mean, you're completely right that they've, you know, they brought one engineer over the over there, and then, you know,
crew chief.
Mr. Motos is Mike's father is, you know, he's been around bikes, and I bet he could take any bike apart and put any bike back together. Got tons of experience, you know, so they've got guys that can all work on the bike, but maybe not necessarily fix every little bit. So, we had 11 people, so if we needed a little task, we just kind of could tell someone to kind of go do it and stuff, which was nice. But, you know, to them have these really well buttoned up bikes, I'm very impressed with how much they could do and all the work they kind of put into it. And, you know, the sort of, you know, the image they can come out with. Cause I mean, we've got what, 20 engineers, and they might have one or two if anyone ever kind of comes in and help, and they've got this whole package already put together. Now, granted, they've got someone with experience and they've got experience in the aisle, but you know, it's impressive when you think about the, you know, the amount of time they're necessarily putting in and with the time and manpower they put in with the end result that they get is, you know, stellar. So yeah. It was cool to see them, and they were great guys, and it was, you know, if that's what the rest of the competition is going to be like, it's fun races, because you learn a lot from each other, and you know, even the bits that, you know, you don't want to tell them everything, but you can get a peek at what they're doing and get an idea for the things they're trying, and the thought processes they're going through are similar to what we're doing on our team. So it's good to see that we don't have a bike nearly as buttoned up as them, but that's the direction we're trying to head. So
yeah, if you're thinking on a similar path and they're that successful, then you must be on the right path.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Mugen, how was it? You got to talk to them a little bit.
Yeah. We talked to them. I mean, I stopped by in the beginning and chatted with, I'm terrible with names, but
Colin.
Yeah. That you got to interview and talked with him, and he was very, very nice. It was great to see them too. He actually even stopped over, I don't know, I think it was the day after race day or whenever we were putting together our crate, and he talked to us a little bit, and we talked a little bit about trying to ship the bikes and stuff and how that went for them. And they were great competition, and I just kept hearing things from people about them being impressed with us as a college team and stuff. And, they let us have a chance to as well of, you know, not having to kind of come into their paddock a little bit where normally they have it sort of fenced off and you just kind of view from the outside. And so we could peek our heads, lean all the way under the bike and see what it's about. And actually this was with some fairings off. So we could get a better idea of what kind of things they did and gives us some ideas moving forward. So it was very, very nice to, the teams are, you know, they might not be as open to the public and stuff like that, but there's a certain level of camaraderie among the teams. And one of the biggest things we, as our team, was trying to preach is sort of openness, that someone could come in, see our bike, ask questions about it, and if they wanted to go build one, we would give them almost enough information or as much information as we could so they could go buy this part or that part. Instead of just saying, this is X motor. Because really, you know, my whole idea is that we go out to race for these people that are walking around the paddock to eventually want to race one of these two or come next year with one. So, but I got that feel from those guys that, you know, they can't necessarily be as open because they have some of the technology they have might be going to someone else that's going to pay them a lot of money for it or is already paying them to develop some of the stuff they're putting in there. So, they have to be. There's more of a business case for them. So, but right. For them to be open with us was, it was. I mean, from that standpoint, that was something maybe I was a little bit nervous about, is it would kind of get a little bit, not bitter, but you know, just competitive, yeah. And you kind of glares and stuff. We're gonna be, you know, you get competitive and stuff, and everyone's been there. But it was, you know, it was better than it could have ever imagined.
Well, I mean, you know, in all honesty, they're running 109. And you guys are 18 miles an hour slower.
Yeah.
You know, if you were running 2 miles an hour slower, it might not have been so friendly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Or as open. Just as friendly, but not as open. There we go. That's a better
way
to think
about it. Yeah, because they knew, they know, okay, these guys know what they're doing already. We don't need to tell them anything.
Yep. All right. What was the reception of being an American team, an American university team, who just showed up first year and beat all the other bikes? You know, because you got the college teams, and you've got the teams like Vickermoto and Man TTX and I can't remember the other one. Apologize. You know, those types of teams. What was it like to just show up 1 year and beat all those guys and have proven that you've done the research?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of a mix. I mean, our team got, you know, us in Imperial College from the UK were some of the first teams there. And so we, you know, the first couple guys they had, we talked with them and chatted with them the first couple nights. So we got along very well with them actually after the race, whenever I had a little barbecue and some drinks with them. So it was good fun. And then some of the other teams were, you know, everyone was receptive and open to communicate and stuff. But there were, during the races and kind of after the races and stuff, you could get a feel from some competitors that there's a certain level of the bitterness about defeat and whatnot. So, you know, that's competing. I mean, everyone wants to win, and you don't necessarily want to get trumped, especially, you know, if someone came, you know, to America on our soil and started beating up on us, you'd want a certain level of bitterness. And I mean, we talked about this a little before, but it's good. It's kind of good to see that though, because that means, you know, these other teams care about this racing, and hopefully they'll come back next year with a bigger and better bike. And, you know, if their goal might just be to beat us, well, they're going to be better. And then at some point we're going to get to the point where maybe we're starting to challenge the Mugens and Motus's guys. So it's all good fun in the end, but there's some racing attitudes there.
That's all good. That's all good. All right. What was it like to work with Rob Barber?
Oh, it was spectacular. I mean, it was from the things just we had no clue about, or just were like, oh, I think it's going to work this way. No, we could show up. The crate got delivered right to his paddock. We knew where it was. We found him. He, you know, had the tools we needed when we didn't have the right plug, or we just forgot ours or broke ours. So it just helped out so much to have someone there, not only experienced with the TT, but experienced with electric racing and prepared for the questions we were going to ask him and the feedback we would want from him. He immediately could give it to us. You know, we took it out to Jerby for some testing, I believe the Wednesday or Thursday before our first practice. And, you know, he was already scraping the belly pan. He could immediately jump on and be ready with it. And then we told him how to like reset the bike, and he actually had some of the reset errors during the first lap and didn't pull in after the first lap. He just reset it himself and kept going because, you know, he didn't freak out with it. He was comfortable with it and kind of knew that there were some quirks that would happen with the electric. So from that standpoint, it was great. But he hooked us up with suspension and tires, just things we don't have any dedicated racing engineers or guys that have even raced motorcycles long enough or enough to kind of be familiar with that kind of stuff. And so we learned so much about how to race. And, you know, without him or, you know, another dedicated rider, we would have missed some of the stuff in our, you know, our front suspension. We would have been bottoming out everywhere, and the lap times could have been 10 miles an hour slower. So, I mean, there's a lot that he did to make us successful, and I'm glad we could get him back on the podium with a bike that could, you know, give him enough to do that.
That's well, and I'm sure he was glad to help you guys out. Mm-hmm. Man, I'm stumped. There's something I'm trying to get to, but I can't quite get it out. How do you think he felt about you guys? Was he impressed with the bike? Is that the fastest he's ever gone in electric?
I believe it is. I believe he did a 89 on I'm not sure. He may have gone faster on an Agni, but I'm not 100% sure. But it's definitely some of the fastest laps he's done repeatedly on some of the bikes, and probably I believe it's definitely probably the highest top speed. There's not a lot of bikes that are going over 110 mile an hour top end at Shelby or anywhere else. So,
but that is pretty cool. You guys hit 122.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I have to see where that ranks on the fastest. I mean, the Motus's bikes have been doing well over that for a couple of years now, but I don't know if anyone, any of the other, you know, not Motus's or Mugen has gone over 120 or anything. But
well, you know, and that's the weird thing. Like last year, Rudder and McGinnis were running about 125.
Mm-hmm.
Down the Sulby straight in the race, whereas Miller was running like 135. But I think that was I think that was part of their race strategy. And Miller would go even faster in practice. I think everyone would go faster down Sulby straight in practice and decide to stay slower.
Yeah.
But this year they were running like 140 Rudder hit down Sulby straight during the race.
Mm.
I mean, yeah. Fudge. Damn, dude.
They're up there, yeah. I mean, those bikes are capable of that. It's just whether the batteries can handle it. Capable from a power standpoint, but whether the batteries can handle it, and you know,
right.
That's really where the rider and the machine and knowing, you know, and then maybe the feedback that the machine is giving the rider in the sense of how much energy you have left. And it's so hard to be predictive because, you know, if he changes anything too much different than what sort of your model predicts that he could do or ride, and you don't know if you're giving him the right feedback that he can cross the line. So it's really almost, you know, even the top teams, it gets to the point of, you know, oh, let's make sure he doesn't have to push. Make sure he doesn't have to push. You know, even they've been doing a lot, but if he goes 5 miles an hour faster too early in the race, there's a chance that he runs out of energy. And even if you've got, you know, our bike, we didn't have a hard limit where it would sort of tell him we had a number. He could kind of, he would still have to self-limit instead of the machine doing it.
He'd have to pop.
And even if it starts to self-limit, you know, there gets to a point where there's just big enough hills at the end and stuff that you're not coming across the line, so.
Yeah, I was going to say he'd have to actually pilot the bike, read the gauges and pilot it. Let's see here. Where did I go? So we worked with Rob Barber. Fast times. It's just so awesome to watch you guys get third. I was listening. I woke up. I don't wake up early for anything anymore. I was in the Navy. I know what 5 a.m. looks like. I know what 4 a.m. looks like. My family doesn't think so, but I know I do. And I'm not in the Navy anymore. I don't do the shop till 10. I don't get up much before 9 in the morning. So, but I, you know, I do this and that at night, so I'm up a bit late. So I got up at 4:30 in the morning, turned my computer on. I already had everything all set up. And listened, I had the app set up on my cell phone to listen to the live radio broadcast and listened, and it was so exciting. You guys went last and you were passing bikes and flying and then 122 down the Sulby straight, and then Miller dropped out and Kingston was close. They were only a mile or two slower than you guys, and it was like, man, is the bike gonna hold out? Are they gonna run another 91? And you guys crossed the line at 90 miles an hour, 1 or 2 miles an hour faster than Kingston, and took the podium, and it was just so freaking cool. And then I went back to sleep. but it was really awesome. Having done all that and gone through the excitement, and I heard through the radio broadcast you guys are hooting, hollering, and screaming, and having a good time,
yep.
And celebrating the win. Well, not well, it's not a win, but kind of is. Yeah. Having done that and gone through all that talk about that, because we talked about it last time, but not it didn't record. So what was it like to go through all that? What was the emotion like? Standing there in the Isle of Man, some foreign country, and realizing that you guys have just podiumed at the T0.
Yeah, I mean, when we heard over the loudspeaker that Miller dropped out, it just kind of got, not necessarily silent, but we all just kind of stared at each other a little bit and started biting an extra inch off the nails. And, you know, immediately when I saw it, the Motus's guys were right over there, kind of looked over, and I'm like, I can't get too excited. You have a feeling of you know, because we wouldn't want to be in their shoes with that bike falling. Luckily, you know, fortunately, I guess for them, they had another bike so they could still cheer on, and they still came away with a victory. But, you know, we were just – a couple of us were down in the pits, and then some other guys were up in the grandstand. But it was just started a feeling of, holy crap, we might do this. You know, thinking back from just when we were just trying to figure out how to put a battery together and – all the way there, it was just sort of, it became sort of real, and your mind starts to race, and it was just, you know, we were still for good 3 to 4 minutes behind the other bikes. That was the longest 3 to 4 minutes it could have been. We're still getting updates, luckily, around the course and on the radio, but there's certain periods of the you know, if he doesn't check in, you see the top bikes check in, and you're like, oh, cool, we're next, but it's like, you're next in 3 to 4 minutes, so it's such a waiting game, and you don't have a video on him or the announcer seeing him the whole time, and it's a bit nerve wracking. But and it was funny because Kingston did come across the line first, and there was a little bit of a cheer from them just because, you know, you kind of get the adrenaline gets you, and you don't necessarily remember that we started a whole minute behind them, and then we finally came about a little over 20 seconds behind them to beat them by 40 seconds, and it was just awesome. We were just running. Started yelling, and yeah, as you said, the announcer made note of us and came down to the podium to see our bike rolled in there. And I mentioned it before, but when I walk around over into the sort of not the podium, but the staging area where they put the bikes, Rob points at me and he goes, "You're getting a foot up your ass," because he had more resets and went slower in the race. And he knows as the technical head that I was sort of kind of in charge of those decisions and stuff. So it was, but after that, I always remember that, and it's a funny story I can remember from that, and you know, seeing him up on the podium, and after he got the wreath for the third place, Rob comes down on the podium and slaps it on my head and takes a swig of the champagne, and then we pass it around the team, and we got to keep all that stuff too. So it's, you know, It was just a real day, and we made sure we did some good celebrating the rest of the day, and happier.
And we shall not talk about that.
I'm still getting pictures.
Things that are legal in the Isle of Man are not necessarily legal in the United States. So anyway, so you had a good time. It was just great. It was just so great, and it was great to show. There's a few things that maybe I'm reading my typical reading too much into things, but not only has America maintained its dominance in this sport, but it's also shown, and fairness to the other teams, you guys did get some sponsorship. Ohio State is not a small school. There's, you know, you guys are pretty well funded.
Yeah.
You know, so all in fairness to the other teams, but, it shows that that American engineering in general is not lacking. When American college student, you know, university students can go there and prove, they're good. Yes, we have more resources, but we're not wasting them. We're not squandering them. There's a reason. So,
yeah,
so that was
the result by, right. You know, I mean, you might be able to point to the things why we went faster, but we still did it in our first year with the minimal experience and as students. And it's just, you know, I've been around electric motorcycles for a good 3 or 4 years and have paid attention to all the other bikes, at least U.S. bikes and guys that have been the TTXGP and how they're racing and know so much about them that, to me, you know, I was fairly confident. You know, that doesn't mean I could predict that things, you know, if things didn't go wrong, you know, this bike was getting around there and doing it. So, you know, it'd always be hard to convince me of, you know, like you said, just something that's kind of unheard of to see that these kids can do it, kind of not against all odds, but it's kind of like one of those things. And to me, I was kind of like, we've got this. I know we can do this. So it was. I think that helped a little bit in the team too as well. When there's certain unknowns of going over, I'm like, we'll get it done, and so it kind of gives us a calmness. But you know, the guys, you know, it was a phenomenal effort in the last couple weeks. It just makes those 16, I don't even know how long, days and up till some of the guys, there were some nights they were there probably from 8 p.m. till noon the next day and working on some of the stuff to just get it all together. And that really makes it worth it. Hopefully they've thought back to that and we're proud that they put that time and effort in. And all the guys just, they dealt with me throughout the whole process. I can be a little bit nitpicky and demanding some of the times just because I know what it takes. I see what it takes from the other teams, and I want that out of us. And, yep. God bless them all, I guess.
Yeah. No, I've been there, done that. Well, no, not exactly, but no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I've led teams and been nitpicky and had to have guys who, yeah. Had to deal with it. Yeah, awesome. Thank you for that. Now, we've celebrated. We've enjoyed the spoils of the Isle of Man. Now you guys get to hang around for the rest of the week and enjoy the racing. What is the Isle of Man experience like from your perspective?
I don't know. It's like the time just didn't pass. It didn't matter. Days of the week went out the window because it was just racing. It was, you race, you eat, you race, you eat. It just kind of, it became, I mean, there were some nights there that I was still like charging till 1 or just tweaking something till 1 a.m. or something like that. And it felt not effortless, but it felt, to me, I felt totally at home and comfortable there doing that stuff and just would love to do that every year. And by the 2 weeks, I wasn't exhausted, worn out too much. I imagine things went wrong, it'd be different, but being in the paddock, and there's a nice community. Not all the riders know each other, but there's groups that know each other, and it's I think it's far surpasses what a race would be like in the States, where kind of everything ends up cramped sort of in one big area, where the Isle of Man, there's people around the whole entire island sort of, and they'll come to the paddock and grandstands, but there's never, huge swarms of crowds and whatnot, and you can really interact with people. They'll come in, and we would let people into our paddock, ask questions and stuff, and the reception was great in that sense. And then, there's nothing like being at the bottom of Bray Hill and watching those bikes. It is a steep hill coming down that, and the bikes just bottom out at the bottom, and they're going 140, and that's right off the starting line. So, I mean, they are full throttle all the way till the bottom, where they just let off enough, and then they go back up, and they end up wheeling off the top, and it's just phenomenal from just watching these bikes, and you go, our bike has to do that too? And the riders, I mean, it's cool to see. The biggest thing for me was cool to see how much the riders were all a big community. They're all competing. From our perspective, it's competition. You're hearing the announcer cheered on. You're like, yeah, 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 for the one, Michael Dunlop, go, 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 and win. But it's, in the end of the day, they're all a group that are just like, it's them against the aisle, not them against each other. So, And it was a beautiful week for us there, too. So, I mean, it's nice, cool weather. It's hilly, though, so you better bring your walking shoes if you're going anywhere. But I would do it again in a heartbeat. And if you're a motorcycle fan or an electric fan, and try to get out there at some point. I'm looking at like my calendar and trying to figure out, all right, how many days next year, because I'll start full time. And there's only a certain number of vacation days I'll have, and I'm like, okay, what's the minimum time I can be there and still have a bike or be part of a team to work on a bike? So
that's awesome. That's awesome.
And maybe I have a little bit different perspective because every day I was over in the paddock, so I didn't get to see even the more amazing parts of the island, of just staying up on the mountain for a day of racing and just watching the crowds up there, or even just. I don't even know really what is the rest of the island, because I was so involved with wanting the bike to get around there fast, but it's
cool.
It's just it's hard to describe beyond that, I guess.
Nice. So, well, I think that's a pretty good clip for the tourist bureau. Let's.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, we and this leads me. Okay, well, it doesn't lead me, but here's a segue for you. We talked about this a lot last time, and I hope you've thought about it. I have personally been critical in the past of having claims of 20 or 30 bikes, mm-hmm. maybe 30 show up, half of those make it one lap around the aisle, half of those finish qualifying, and half of those finish the race, and you end up with a race with four or five bikes that finish. So I would rather, to me, this year was a massive success because we had 10 bikes show up.
Yes,
10 bikes show up. Every single one of them got at least two laps. Now, I'm going to put a caveat in there, a little asterisk. Last year, this is the first year with three practices plus the race. Yeah. Last year, there was two practices, but because of the weather, one of those got canceled. Yep. So last year's a bit of an exception, and I think why many bikes didn't make it to, because the time kept changing, the start mm-hmm. time for the race kept changing. Exactly. Because of the three laps, practice plus the race, so four laps, plus the good weather, all of the bikes got at least two laps in. And I'd say eight of them got at least three, and I think like five or six got all four laps. I mean, we had really consistent performance out of most of the bikes.
Yeah.
And eight bikes finished the race, which is the most bikes finishing since the 2009, where they had nine bikes finish, but it is the highest percentage of race finishers in the Isleman TT0 history, or TTXGP history, if you include that first year in 2009.
Yeah.
To me, that is what is successful about it. But you had a really good point about how you had talked about, and I'm trying to lead you into it so you can do more talking than me, but about how the gas bikes is like, they're constantly going by. So can you tell me about that?
Yeah. I have sort of two points on this, and I'll talk about the gas bikes going by. It's like, so the gas bikes, there's good. I know the race numbers go all the way into the 70s. I don't really know if there's actually that many bikes. The paddock does not seem large enough to hold that many people. It's actually a lot smaller than it would seem. But anyways, you know, if they've got 50 to 70 bikes going and they have six laps and they're staggered starts, so, you know, if you're a fan sitting somewhere, maybe the first lap you only see bikes for the first 10 minutes of the 17, 18 minute lap. But by the end, the bikes are all spread out. And actually, there's some that have caught each other. So there's points where there's a couple bikes going by quick. But, you know, you have a good hour and 45 minutes of continual bikes going by at least every 30 seconds. And so, you know, you get to experience that every time the woo, 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 the bike's just flying by you or going through a technical turn or something. You don't get that with electrics just because you've only got one lap and you only have eight guys. You've got if you're lucky, three-minute window if they're all with each other, but it's kind of spread out where you just kind of see a bike and then you wait. Like I said, our bike takes 3 to 4 minutes to finish beyond Motosys or Mugen. So, you know, what are you doing in that 10 minutes? You're just staring at the finish line. So I think from a fan perspective, that's really what they would want to see is more bikes. No matter what the speeds are, more bikes, and, you know, I don't think another lap would help it because you're still seeing the same amount of bikes and you're probably going to see less end up finishing in that regard or going quite a bit slower, which I think as a fan, you don't necessarily get the full perspective if it's 20 mi- if this bike's going 20 miles an hour slower than this one, but maybe when you get to, you know, 40 or 50, it's a big difference. So really, I think having bikes, more bikes there, whether or not they're really competitive or not, is what is going to cling the fans and then, you know, sponsors, because that's, you know, they'll want to put their name on there so the fans will see the name and go buy something from them. You know, I'm not too much of a marketing guy, but that's what I sum it up as. I got another perspective too from some guys. I was chatting with some friends of Rob, when we were in the, I think he was doing a super bike race and they were looking for him, but he was away. About, you know, I was talking about how we were trying to go faster. You know, this year it was 110, next year it's 115, then it's 120, and, you know, how long, you know, I think I made the stat of, I think, you know, 5 to 7 years before you see the bikes doing anything up in the 125, 130, and they gave me the perspective that there's only a select number of guys that can actually go 120 miles an hour on any bike around the aisle. And, you know, a lot of the mini twins, or the lightweight twins, excuse me, they're doing 100 mile an hour to 115
the fastest,
mile an hour
they
last.
Broke 115 this year. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's basically where sort of the electrics would fit, you know, if everyone's got I kind of see Moto-Sys as what is possible with current technology, sort of, you know. That's right in the middle of those. So, I mean, and, you know, even if you put, I guess what I'm saying is, you put some of the newer riders on the Moto-Sys bikes, they don't go quite as fast. So, you know, we're going to get to the point where we don't really need to be going much more than 115, 120. That's enough for the fans. They're not going to notice that difference. They're going to see it on the stat sheets and the spec sheet. And us guys that are more technical want to see that because we're knowing we're pushing the limits more and stuff like that. But it's not going to basically draw that many more people to be trying to say you want to go that much faster, especially when you get up to the 115, 120. But hey, instead of making it faster, let's make it cheaper so I can make two bikes like Moto-Sys does and bring them there. Not that they do it cheaply, but no. I'm just, you know, you can kind of start to think maybe instead of once you get to a certain speed that you don't have to push it that much further. It's just going to be engaging the fans, and that leads back to getting more bikes there, or, you know, if they're going 120s, maybe lower it back down to 100 and do two laps so the fans can at least see the bikes twice.
I think two laps. Once you get the bikes up to 120, you know, I mean, hopefully by the time we see 120, the battery technology will have made the leap that we're all waiting for, and two laps would be 110 mile an hour lap. Or is that a little too hopeful?
I don't know what time scale you're going to look on, but I could see the bikes doing two 90 mile an hour laps in 3 years, if that's what it is. I think it'll really depend. Like, I don't think the Isle of Man will do it until there's a large, I don't know. I'm actually kind of thinking they won't do two laps for quite a while now. Cause I really think, I mean, they've been doing the racing for so long. They know what the fans will want and what kind of they've hopefully looked at that kind of stuff. And I think it's really just gonna. It's better to keep it one lap and try to get the grid to grow more and more. So now you've got, you know, the top dogs fighting, and then you might have some people in the middle pack fighting, and then even the guys in the low end, because maybe you'll have some guys that are bringing a much smaller, lighter bike or something that can't do much more than 80. But they did it real cheaply, and, you know, just one guy out of his garage or something and is bringing it. And, I mean, that some of the teams are that, really. And so it's still competitive. You know, everyone's kind of fighting for their, you know, not different classes, but you'd almost kind of put them in, you know, we're kind of fighting to be the top university, not right. necessarily beat the Moto-Sys or Mugen. Hopefully in the future we're also fighting them. But
there were three kind of groups. There were the Moto-Sys and Mugen, which are obviously in a league of their own, and no disrespect to anyone, but, I mean, 109 mile an hour lap, you just can't argue with that. And then there was the university group, and then there was the three teams, the three small privateer built out of the garage teams. You know, well, I mean, Vercomoto put a quarter of a mil into their bike, I think. So, and then Man TTX and I know there's a third one, and I can't for life remember who they are, but. Yeah, I mean,
Kamadi.
Oh yes, the Japanese team.
Yeah,
Kamadi. So, and they, Praza, I think, is who they used to be.
Yeah.
So, okay, let me ask you this: Impulse TTXs, or even Impulse Rs with suspension and lightweight mods and clip-ons and things like that, and Zero S 11.4s. Why not? Is there any reason that you can think of that they couldn't actually race two electric classes at the same time? You have an electric super sport class or super stock, whatever you want to call it, and the prototypes. And my reasoning is this, because on a regular road race course, you know, a race circuit, those bikes are going to get lapped. But we're doing a TT, and every bike goes off once every, 30 seconds or?
10 seconds.
Every 10 seconds. A bike goes off every 10 seconds. So it's one at a time. It's around the whole island. It's only one lap. Would that be a pretty easy turnkey way to get bikes on the grid?
Yeah, they might, I'm trying to think. Yeah, because probably with the next year model, they'll squeeze a little bit more energy into them, and that'll be enough to make them a, 80, they might actually be able to go faster than that, because they're not going to have too much corner clearance. Because that's the thing, it's hard for me to tell, because since we had so much clearance issue, whether a lot higher, how much faster he could have gone with more corner speed without using any more energy. So knowing how much batter they need, I guess that's what I'm starting to think in my head with these the Brammos or the Zero bikes. But yes, from a not looking at the technical how fast they would go necessarily. Yes, I think that would be. I think it'd be great if Zero shipped over five of their production bikes, or even got a group of owners together or something.
That'll never happen. I'm talking about people going to European dealerships and buying the bikes and doing it themselves, because there's no way Zero will ever ship bikes. Brammo might pony up some money and help. Hollywood Electric should probably get behind it, but I don't see Zero doing it. But I'm talking about privateers, just going out and buying a bike like they would a gas bike.
If there was a grid with them on there, they would definitely fit in the pack. They would kind of stay with the rest of the bikes. And like you said, I mean, they if they start later in the grid because they're times, they're not in anybody's way. Even if they are, you're only getting, the Motoses or Mugens are going to be flying past you when they need to pass you, and you're not, it's not, there would be no safety issues or anything like that. They fit the bill and would do it pretty well. So,
I mean, they're using half the power. I mean, Shalina, she actually hit 116 miles an hour on the TTX on the front straight at Thunder Hill, back their second race with the AFM, which is pretty darn impressive without any race fairings. on a slightly modified Impulse R, so it's not like they got the controller turned up a whole lot. So these bikes are half the power of yours. I mean, they're 54 horsepower. Well, I don't know, the Zero S.
We're about 86 horsepower.
Yeah, 86 to the 86 to the rear wheel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're 86 to the rear wheel. These are rated at 54 horsepower to the motor. Although the Zero S did dyno at 58. Is it an S or a DS? Yeah. There's I'll have to send you the link. There was a Facebook video posted by one of the Zero dealers.
Cool.
They ran it on the dyno. So they're using half the power. That's all they've got. They're a hell of a lot less weight. The Zero S probably weighs half of what your bike does. No, more than half.
Go ahead. 380, I think, is the Zeros. I imagine actual on race day, we're probably at 600.
Yeah. Okay. So 2/3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The Zero would be 2/3, and the TTX is stripped down. They're like 470, but I think they're 425 in race trim, a TTX. So a Zero S would be even lighter, in race trim.
What? How do they can't get that much weight out of it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they took the charger off. Charger
weighs 10 pounds.
It weighs more than that, I think.
No, I know exactly what the model is. I've looked long enough, I know it's 10 pounds. But,
Racing Wheels.
Yeah, that takes a bit off. Okay.
And then there's a couple pounds over stock. And then the Olean suspension weighs a lot less.
Next time you get Brian on, you have to get him to quote the figure of that TTX.
He already did. Listen, he did in my one of my race interviews.
Okay. I'll have to look at. I'll believe you now. You talk to the right people. You know what you're talking about. So.
Well, no, I'm just quoting Brian. If he's talking out of his ass, that's his problem.
Now we're getting in trouble.
Yeah, I know. I'm in all kinds of trouble now.
No, I'm just very impressed if they got that much weight out of it. And so.
Yeah, well, I mean, you start taking headlights off, blinkers off.
Yeah, okay. I'm thinking, I guess the one thing I'm thinking is that it's like they took a racer and then souped it up. So, or they took like a street, yeah. I wasn't thinking of all that kind of stuff in your.
Oh, yeah, you'd start taking all the street gear off and all the wiring that you don't need and oh yeah, you start losing some weight in a hurry, and then lightweight clip-ons and lightweight superbike spec brakes, and the Olean suspension weighs nothing, and I was surprised. He said it was like 425.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense when you put all that perspective.
So we're getting really
charger, and then you know the wheels, but you add in the headlight, and
yeah,
because I've spent time and weighed not. Absolutely everything on my R6, but I've kind of gotten it down where I know what percentage of sort of the weight that the headlight's going to be. I mean, that's almost, on mine, it was almost 7 pounds when you include sort of all the mounting brackets and stuff. So it's a significant chunk.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So, we're looking at, because we're gone into speculation land, but it's awful fun.
Yeah.
We're looking at, they use half the power, very lightweight. We know they can handle, especially the TTX. We know that thing rails, or the Impulse period rails. The Zero S, I gotta talk to Jeremiah Johnson. He's out. He's been testing at Pikes Peak, so that'll be good to see how that bike's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we know they're light. We know they handle. It's almost a completely different. They're almost completely different bikes. They're very lightweight, low power. They're more like the 650 Light Twins, just you know. But they are limited on power. But they're not going to use as much. So I mean, with those factors, they're small, they're light, they corner high speed. But they don't have a lot of energy on board. But they're not using a lot of energy because they don't have big motors.
Yeah.
So it's still over an 80 mile lap out of those. You think?
Yeah, definitely over. Especially, I think the biggest thing is they put fairings. I think they would really want to put some sort of at least kind of front nose fairing with a nice windscreen. I don't think a rider's going to go around the aisle without a windscreen. so they slap those on, and yeah, I think they would. It'd be interesting to get. Is it Brandon Miller? Is he the one that has the Zero and's been doing some club
racing? Yeah, he's been been experimenting with SV650 race bearings.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to get his perspective on, you know, if he could tell us it made my top speed this much or it dropped the power I needed at this speed this much to just kind of see what kind of difference it made. So
Brian hinted, and I don't know if it was a coy hint or if it was a real hint or I'm just imagining things like I like to do. But when I did do my very last race interview where his phone connection was crap and it sounded horrible, it wasn't much I could do about it. He did mention, he's like, yeah, she hit 116 and that was without race bearings. Maybe we should get her some. You know, he said something to that effect. And,
yeah.
I suspect we'll see something from Brammo. I mean, they've been working on the aerodynamics on the RR, and you know Brammo, the stuff from the race program does filter down to the race product. I mean, I had both Brian mentioned it, and I kind of half believed it when Brian said it, but then mercy, who won the world championship? Steve Atlas. Thank you. Steve Atlas told me at Daytona. He's like, yeah, the new Impulse is pretty much last year's race bike. Yes, he said, actually, he said straight up it is last year's race bike. Then he's like, well, pretty much. You know? And so, I mean, you know that's coming down. But, and Kenyon Kluge is a lead engineer, electrical engineer at Zero, and he goes out and tests the new stuff on the racetrack. That's usually there's something new in that bike when he's out on the racetrack that he's hammering and testing out and see how it works. So getting some data. So we'll see. I think it'd be cool. So you think it'd fill the grid? It wouldn't be much slower than the prototypes, is what we're thinking.
No, I don't. Because I mean, it's the nice thing is you've got reliability already kind of built into them. Now the aisle's a different place, but you know, and that's some of the things that keep some of the teams going slower is that, you know, something had broke, so now they're making a compromise, or they just couldn't necessarily, you know, they could afford a nice motor or something, but couldn't quite get the battery on board. They needed to supplement the system. These Zeros and Brembos are balanced systems. You're not gonna overheat one. I mean, you still could at the aisle, like I'm saying, but they're well set up. They give you that reliability that you need to then make the rider faster at the aisle.
Yeah. They can actually start riding the bike.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, and just pinning it. Like, here you go, pin it. See where you run out, then back off. You know?
Yeah.
Sweet, sweet. All right. And we haven't seen anyone mess with the controllers too much. Jeremiah Johnson, Hollywood Electrics, they're going to go after that. He's got a Zero S, and there's no official ESS award this year, so it's kind of open room for teams like him and Brembo to start tweaking things on those bikes and seeing how hard they can push them. So, and see what they can get away with for next year's ESS rules. All right, cool. So we feel we're in agreement, not that we're anyone. You know, well, you're way more than I at this point, hence you now have, you know, a podium at the Isle of Man, so your voice is now has to be respected. Yeah, okay, so that's enough dreaming for now. Enough bench racing. Shipping the bike. This is interesting. What has been your experience? And the bike still isn't back from the aisle.
No, it actually, I don't think it's left England yet. It's definitely in it's in Liverpool, I believe. But UK customs going out are a little bit different than coming in, so they're kind of delaying it, but I think the shipping company we're working with is great, that they're working everything out and doing it for us, but it's definitely been a big hassle, and shipping by boat takes a good 4 to 5 weeks, because we're actually, we still believe we want to be doing Indy, but if we can't get the bike back quick enough, and get, because we still, you know, like we said, we're having controller reset issues and having things that we couldn't explain, so we've got to do testing before going to Indy, just from a reliability safety standpoint, to check off that it works. So, I mean, but, you know, shipping has been rough, but both Motoseas and Mugen have pretty much worked it out where it's still, you know, a good week, but they're actually able to air ship, so, you know, we believe that doing that will give us another 3 weeks of testing or building if it comes down to that, and we'll just make the process a lot smoother, because we get it to whatever airport we need to, flies out, flies in. It's not, you know, because I think we took it, you know, we gave it to a crater, it got trucked up to Canada, got on a boat, got sent to Liverpool, and then had to be ferried over. So I guess we still have to be ferried over from the UK, but it would be only 1 or 2 weeks of nervous, I hope it's in one piece, where it was 4 or 5, and doggone batteries.
Yeah, yeah.
Just start labeling them as, I don't know, we'll start putting like, I don't know, some weird labels of some food products on them. Some crackers or something. I don't even know.
All right, fair enough.
Then we get in a heat load of trouble, so
probably
not do that. But
yeah,
now, there's been talk of people had the ideas of, hey, why don't we just get a whole different set of batteries shipped to the aisle like 2 months in advance, and then we'll just ship the bike, you know, a week before, and then put these new batteries in. And I'm like, go for it, but I'm not putting that bike back together.
Well, I think that was how Lightning did things.
Yeah, I think they ended up trying that and had a lot of trouble putting it back together.
Well, they had issues with the promised batteries were like a week late.
Mm.
They ended up with like, it was in Richard Hatfield's interview, and it was like 3 days before the race or something, and it was like, what the hell? So it ended up being like driven like, you know, last minute from Germany across Europe on something crazy like that. All right, so shipping is becoming a pain, but there's a streamlined process is being found.
Yeah, and I think the aisle's always willing to work with you for the most part. I mean, they'll give you help. The biggest thing is just I would always try to ship the bike as a whole, because even if it is running late in a manner, if you can pull it out and only make a few tweaks on it or whatever things you devised over those 3 weeks you want to change, and then go out there, you don't want to have to worry about putting a battery back together, especially if you used anything that's got standard sizes and you have to bring your own tools. Oh, crap, I forgot the 5/16. Now I can't put any of this together. You're running around the paddock, so it's... Even if the added cost or the added time, having it in one piece going over there is, I think, the way to go. I mean, and, you know, there's one example where Lightning wasn't able to get it back together, but like you said, it was maybe a little different circumstance. But I don't think the shipping, it was new to us, and so it was kind of hard. It was just something we'd never done, and even the hazmat shipper we had never necessarily done something like it. So I think the key is to just find somebody that's done it and work through them, and it'll be a lot smoother. There's no reason it had to be quite as tricky for us. It was more just having the manpower to do it, and none of us had the knowledge, so we just were kind of flopping around, like, who was taking the lead on it.
Sounds like a typical day in my bicycle shop. Richard will work on the carbon bikes. He's not scared of them. Anyway. all right. So what are the plans for the future? What are the immediate plans? And then you're graduated. So mm-hmm. there's a point where you already have or are in the process of handing the reins over to the next individual. I'm thinking of your particular role.
Yeah.
So what's the plans for the Buckeye Current?
So we did have a team meeting, and we said, I don't want to spill too much of the beans, just because some of the stuff is still maybe in limbo, but we're definitely all excited to take another assault at the aisle. You know, how we're going to approach it is still in development, but we're fairly certain that that's what we want to do and continue to do, and that we'll get support to do it. We are having some meetings in the next couple weeks with some sponsors, so, you know, we'll definitely be able to create something better than last year, not only from just getting rid of the things that didn't work and replacing them, but replacing them with something that can do more. So that's looking good, and I'm definitely staying on through, you know, the beginning of August a little bit, and would love to stay on as an advisor role in some regard, but it's kind of, I've started to, as you said, I've graduated, so it's, I don't want to, you know, you don't want to start transforming it from a student project. Not that it couldn't necessarily become, you know, something more that the privateers are doing. And I sure as heck plan on still building my bike up and whatnot, but, you know, let the team sort of decide how much, you know, what they want to, how, what, I'm sure, sorry, I'm kind of ranting, but what, how they want to utilize me as a resource. So they're still sort of figuring that out, and we're restructuring a little bit because I did take a very broad technical role in trying to spread that to more people to get it done. And I've been doing a lot in the last couple of weeks of knowledge sharing and sort of trying to get a lot of the stuff I know down on paper for the guys. So, but there's definitely plenty. I mean, we've got a very good core, and it'll be great to see moving forward. So, a little bit of restructure. Like I said, we're shooting to do Indy, but again, we built a bike to race the aisle, so we're not shooting for any records or even any too great of finishes. Just, you know, be relatively competitive and get some data and get some of the people that didn't get the chance to get to the aisle to experience racing and understand, you know, what this machine that just sits on two wheels in the paddock and we build around actually is meant to do. So,
yeah.
But it'll depend on shipping and whether or not we got to see if we actually need to lose weight or not. We're working with the TTXGP to kind of see how flexible they are and if they'll let us run and whatnot. So those are the kind of things we're moving forward. But things, for the most part, are positive for the team, and it should be exciting.
Oh, yeah, because you guys are like 50 pounds overweight.
Yeah, if we're actually at 600, We waited after our testing, and it was 581. There's been bits, you know, I haven't been able to keep track of which bits are actually on it and which bits aren't. So I always just kind of, I think basically every week I just add a pound just to be sure that I'm not undershooting it. And, you know, this week I've decided it's all the way up at 600, but I have a feeling that's probably a good thing to do when we pull it off of the, out of the crate is throw everything on it and weigh it just to see what we ended up with it. That'll be another sort of data point for our comparisons. So,
cool, very cool. So we'll hopefully see you at Indy as long as the bike returns safely and within time.
Yeah, I'll be there. I'm hoping to be there with my R6 no matter what. But it's keep our fingers crossed that the RW2 RW2 will be there for us. So.
Sweet, sweet. All right, so immediate future is an Indy, and then probably that's the only road race you'll do.
Yeah, because we really
want to have a summer to yourselves and.
Yeah, money. I mean we've got, you know, classes start again in us in August, so actually that weekend after Indy classes start, so it's a little bit harder for a college team, especially once we've already spent so much money getting to the Isle of Man. And that we think we want to focus on that, so we don't want to not waste our resources, but we want to make sure we keep the focus, you know, on our goal. Not that to say we wouldn't do road races in the future and stuff, but you know, we think we want to be an Isle of Man team, and we want to be good at being an Isle of Man team. So it takes a certain level of not being. And I know you'll probably end up giving us crap for it if we don't make it to other grids, but. I kind of will too. I want to see, you know, if a bike does well and there's not problems and there's not, you know, the shipping issue of delay, it's got the funds and can get there, you want to see it there. But, you know, this is kind of things, you know, some of the reasons why.
I give the college teams a lot of leeway because you guys are, well, I mean, I think it's only reasonable. You guys have school. You have, you know, the schedule that school relates to, so you have to deal with, you know, getting funding from school administrators and from sponsors, but your school year starts in August and ends in May, and it's complete opposite of how racing season goes, and there's all these complications, and your college kids, hell, you know, I give grown people who say, I'm going to race this season, who don't show up, and then don't bother to tell anyone, oh, we're not going to make it this year. You know, if you fessed up and said, look, sorry, we couldn't make it this year, that's one thing. But no one does that. So then
that's true.
I get angry.
No, and rightfully so. And, like, and I mean, the whole thing and you're totally right, is that the easiest way to get the Isle of Man TT0 bigger and better is more teams. Because more support will flood in, and so I can completely agree that if there's a functional bike out there that's within 3,000 miles of the track, it should be there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, you know,
it's a different discussion for a different day, but.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a rabbit hole we could go down for a while. All right, man. Well, we've been at this for a little over an hour, so I've been told I'm going to try to start keeping these things to an hour. I'm going to try. But what's that?
You have to email an agenda out beforehand with the time, you know, we will spend. It might actually work because I could, while I'm sitting here talking on my computer, I can be like, oh crap, we got to move on.
Well, I used to do this and I'm going to start doing it again because Brian told me I need to up my game. But, which it slowly, I think is slowly, gradually upping, but. I actually wrote out questions, and so I was like, okay, I want to hit here and hit here. So hopefully these things will be more structured and worth paying a dollar for if I can ever figure out how to get the lettering to show right. But I haven't issues. I don't know anything about CSS code, and I've been told that I can fix my visual issues easily if I knew anything about it, but I don't know anything about it. So.
Well, good luck with that, because I can't tell you anything better.
Yeah, I've got some friends. I've got some friends, so I just need a bit of help. But all right, man, I really appreciate your time, and dealing with my craziness and like, well, I won't talk this week. I'm tired. So.
Of course.
All right, man. You take care.
Yep. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Huge thanks to Kyle. Just a fun interview. We talk about a lot of stuff. We geek out there for a while. Really insightful, especially the whole shipping process. That was really cool. Big props again to Motosys for beating Mugen. They came with a much different bike this year and still beat them. So big, big props, especially doing it with such a small crew. Anyway, big, big props to, you know, Buckeyes for getting third, man. I mean, and just being able to listen to how that whole experience went and his point of view from that. And then we did get to geek out about, you know, how to fill the grid with, like, e-superstock bikes and, you know, that type of thing. You know, basically being able to, you know, people being able to go and buy a Zero or a Brammo and go race it in the Isle of Man. So we, I think we went a little far with that, but it was all in fun. And I really don't know how light only suspension is. I'm just assuming it's really light. So, if you actually know and are screaming at the podcast, just, you know, hate mail richard@espk.co. Yeah. So, you know, big thanks. It was great going to back to the Wayback Machine. All right. Well, thanks for sticking with me and, shoot, keep the rubber side down and I'll see you next podcast.